do. Krishna says, time I am.
Destroyer of worlds.
Extra point.
In Krishna temples, in the morning hours, this is the melody for the Mangala Arati. Mangala means auspicious. Auspicious because it's really early in the morning. Usually about 4:30 in the morning. And I remember as a lad, when I was living in Krishna temples, that was the routine. Get up early, take a shower, usually cold water, not hot water. Sounds worse than it was, I promise you. It really sounds worse than it was. Rising early, taking a nice, let's call it a brisk shower, shall we, instead of a brisk shower. And then going into the temple room where you're expectantly waiting for the curtains. Imagine this is a large altar instead of a small altar. And those white pieces of cloth, long curtains, behind which are the 4 or 5 foot tall marble deities of Radha and Krishna. And then the pujari or temple attendant would very slowly open those curtains, and there's this reveal of the deities in their nightgowns, because they will have just gotten up from having slept during the night. And so they're there with their nightgowns, and you would greet them with this beautiful morning melody, except it had a bit of a beat to it, so it would be more like something like this. Wake up. You're kind of raring to go. Someone was asking me about what life was like at that. There used to be a temple on 55th Street between 8th and 9th Avenues here in New York back in the 70s. And it was a big building. It was like a 12-story building. And there were hundreds of devotees and residents there. And so that morning Mangala Arati, huge. You'd come down. There were maybe 8 mridanga drummers, 5 or 6 kartal players, a smattering of other instruments. And when those curtains opened, all chaos ensued. And, you know, you bow down to the deities and you get up. And there was this, it was a real New York group. You know, we had some uptowners and some downtowners. And, you know, everyone was wailing on these drums. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. You know, at 4:30 in the morning. Like, really go. That's how you'd start your day. So anyway, that's the morning melody. If you hear it, well, now you'll recognize the morning melody. How's everybody doing? Look at you all, bright-faced and chipper and ruddy-cheeked. Just all energized from whatever your week was like. Anything that you'd like to report to the group? Hello. Anybody here for the first time? Yes, I see a couple of first time. I was noticing you were reading a book about Christ and Krishna. Very interesting. There are a couple of books like this. Is that Steve Rosen's book?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a good buddy. I was just talking with him earlier today. Wonderful writer. Manages to pick provocative topics to write on. He has a book called Om Shalom. This is a dialogue between Steve and a rabbi talking about, you know, parallels in Judaism and the Bhagavad Gita. You know? And here's this one between Christ and Krishna. Yeah, wonderful. So, greetings, those of you who are newies. And hi there to the oldies. And I bring you greetings from Gainesville, Florida. I was just down there Friday. We had a George Harrison concert. Tribute concert at the University of Florida. Place was jammed. You know, there were, I don't know, 700 people or so. And the devotee bhajan band played along with the Godfrey Townsend group. It was beautiful, just lovely. So if you hear me making a few George Harrison references tonight, you'll have to think I got George on the brain right now. It was wonderful and it was warm. So, I thought just for fun I'd start our little gathering this evening by reading you a children's book. Is that okay? This is the second book in the series of The Friendship of Surya and Roscoe. the orangutan and the dog who made friends at the Tigris Preserve in South Carolina. The first book was called Surya and Roscoe. This one is called Surya Swims. Now, what's extraordinary about this is that orangutans don't swim. The evolutionary history of the orangutan dictates that they not go near water, because if they go near water, they're going to get eaten by crocodiles or other carnivorous aquatic creatures. So orangutans do not swim. However, in the environment of the Tigris Preserve in Myrtle Beach, where their needs are met, they don't have to emphasize the predatory or defensive side of their nature. Other parts of their behavior can emerge. And so there are these extraordinary friendships that are developed, like between a dog and an orangutan, or an elephant and a, you know, baboon. I mean, all kinds of amazing friendships go on down there. There is a chimpanzee named, what is her name? It'll come to me. So there's a chimpanzee who's decided that she is the nurse for all the young tiger cubs. So whenever a tiger gives birth down there, she goes in and takes charge and feeds them their bottles and changes their diapers. I mean, they don't change their diapers, but, you know, make sure that they're happy and plays with them and cares for them. It's this amazing thing that goes on there. So I guess people are like that too. If you're always having to defend yourself, right, and be predatory, then other parts of your personality don't really get a chance to emerge. So anyway, here's the story, Surya Swims, the true story of how an orangutan learns to swim. Okay, I'll try to hold this up so you can see it. Here you see Surya with a, I think that's a bear cat on her shoulders. And okay, Surya the orangutan and his best friend Roscoe the dog played outdoors all day. Okay, they ran around and rolled on the ground until it was time to go indoors with Surya's human friend Moksha. That's Moksha down here. She is this extraordinary animal caregiver at the Tigris Preserve in Myrtle Beach. Many other animals live there too. What did a busy orangutan like Surya do after a full day of play? He took a bath. The bath was Moksha's idea, but Surya loved to splash around in a tub full of soapy bubbles. Sometimes Surya took a bath with his orangutan friends. The other orangutans didn't enjoy having a bath as much as Surya did. That's because most orangutans do not like water. Okay? All right. Next page. There's more pictures of them playing around in the bathtub. And it says, most orangutans do not have a dog for a best friend either. Surya was different. He even took baths with Roscoe. Roscoe was happy when they were finished, but for Surya, bath time was still playtime. Surya had such a good time in the tub that Moksha decided to bring him to the pool. Now, down at the Myrtle Beach Preserve, they've built an elephant swimming pool. It's with one of those big glass fronts, that so it's half you see above the water and half you see under the water. And they bring the tigers in to go swimming and the elephants and, you know, all the animals go swimming. Surya watched Moksha swim. Every time she passed Surya, Moksha reached up and tickled him. Surya loved this new game. So here is an orangutan becoming acclimated to water. Many of Surya's friends swam in the pool too. Bubbles the elephant moved gracefully through the water, leaving behind a trail of bubbles. Tonks the tiger paddled in the pool on hot summer days, and little Andar, the baby bear, enjoyed taking a dip with Moksha. Okay. Everyone was having such a good time, Surya liked to have a good time too. So one day, while Moksha was in the pool, Surya put his head under the water and looked at her. That was fun. Surya dunked his head again and again. At first, he put his finger under his nose to keep the water out, but he quickly learned how to hold his breath. Now, this is an extraordinary thing, an orangutan holding her breath underwater. This has not been recorded before. There are some instances reported of orangutans wading a little bit in shallow water, but not dunking their heads under the water. Before long, Surya went all the way into the pool. He held his breath and moved his arms and legs. He moved forward in the water. Surya was swimming. He was doing something no other orangutan had ever done before. He was swimming just for fun. Swimming in the pool became one of Surya's favorite things to do. He was so comfortable in the water that he didn't always need his life vest. So now he's really swimming. And there is one of the beautiful Bengal tigers swimming there. Yeah. Incredible. Isn't that an amazing photo? Isn't that something? It's extraordinary. Surya especially loved to swim with Moksha. Sometimes he would hold her hand, and sometimes he would give her a big hug in the water. There they are, underwater. This is a baby tapir. A tapir is an animal that looks kind of like a weird mini rhinoceros. And it's an animal that, according to paleontological estimates, has not changed its shape in 50,000 years. Same as that has been throughout history. Extraordinary looking creature. The pool scene became another fun place where Surya and Roscoe often played together. Surya also swam a lot with Offie the otter. Now this is lovely. You've got to come see this after class. I'm going to put it out. There's this little otter looking like this. Up at Surya. He swam with Baku the tapir. Even a pair of leopard cubs got their fur wet with Surya. But Surya had the most fun in the water with the tigers. Tigers just love being in the water. Look at this picture over here. Isn't that great? I mean, look at that. Communing with the tigers in the pool. How does that sound? That's like a fun weekend. Surya also learned to dive. He loved to hold his breath and swim down in the water. Moksha would surprise Surya by putting things into play. He especially liked the pretty plastic rings that he sometimes found there. He was diving for objects found in the pool. Here's the final picture in the book. Surya is no ordinary orangutan. He liked to try as many new things as possible. That's how he came to have a dog for a best friend. It's how he learned to enjoy the water. And it's how he discovered he could swim and dive. There was no telling what Surya might do next. You guys with what do you call those? Jet skis. Okay, so that's coming out from Holt Publishing, I think this month it'll be out. Okay, that was fun. Did everybody get their little Jolge card here? It's a little souvenir for you to take home. This is a quote, the only way out is within. That's a quote from the title song in the posthumous album Brainwashed. That his son Danny produced after George Harrison passed away. Anyway, we'll have these little gifties from time to time. We'll take them home. Okay, so what else we got? Let's see. Let's go to our verse, shall we? Do you have your Bhagavad Gita's? Okay, we're in chapter 3. Quelle surprise. Chapter 3. Been here for a while now. And we are on page 171 in the hardbound edition. It's text 35. So if you would kindly repeat the invocation after me, and then we'll recite the Sanskrit. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Your turn. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. 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 Text 35. Shreyan Svadharmo Viguna. Try that. Just try saying that first. Shreyan Svadharmo Viguna. Shreyan Svadharmo Viguna. Para Dharmat Svanushtitat. Para Dharmat Svanushtitat. Those of you who are not familiar with these little dots and lines, in Sanskrit, these are called diacritic marks, and they are hints as to how a particular letter or syllable should be pronounced. So you have the line over the S, and the first word becomes a sh. So shreyan, the long line over an A, goes from an a to an a sound. So shreyan svadharmo viguna para dharmat svanushtitat. The dot under the S is almost the same thing as an accent aigu. I don't know how to call that in English. The accent over the S. So svanushtitat. And the putting it to a melody, it would sound something like this. Shreyan svadharmo viguna. You want to try that? Shreyan svadharmo viguna. Para dharmat svanushtitat. Para dharma svanushtitat. Svadharme nidanang shreya. Svadharme nidanam shreya. Svadharme nidanam shreya. Again. Svadharme nidanam shreya. Para dharmo bayavaha. Para dharmo bayavaha. Svadharme nidanam shreya. Svadharme nidanam shreya. Try that again. Svadharme nidanam shreya. Para dharmo bayo bayavaha. Para dharmo bayavaha. Para dharmo bayavaha. Para dharmo bayavaha. Let's try reciting the entire verse all together, shall we? Shreyan svadharmo viguna. Para dharma svanushtita. Svadharme nidanam shreya. Para dharmo bayasvaha. You guys are getting good at this. That was nice. Want to try it once more? All right, here we go. Shreyan svadharmo viguna. Para dharmat svanushtitat. Svadharme nidanam shreya. Para dharmo bayavaha. That's lovely. Well done. Here, here. Anyone want to try? I always ask this. No one ever says yes. Someone's got to jump into the fray here. If Surya can jump in the swimming pool, you can chant the verse. All right, go for it. Shreyan svadharmo viguna. Para dharma svanushtita. Extra credit. Well done, well done. Anyone else want to give it a try? How about some newies? What do you think, newie? Give it a try?
I don't have the best singing voice.
Oh, sorry, you don't have to have a good singing voice. Give it a try. In your own voice, whatever key you would like.
Shreyan svadharmo viguna. Para dharma svanushtita. Svadharma viguna shreya.
Superlative. Well done. Thank you. What's your name?
Jen.
Jen. Thank you very much. Anyone else? One more slot. One more go at it. Who wants to try? Go for it.
Shreyan Swadharma Viguna.
Well, here's the translation to this 35th verse of chapter 3. It is far better to discharge one's prescribed duties, even though faultily, I'm not quite sure about that word, than another's duties perfectly. Destruction in the course of performing one's own duty is better than engaging in another's duties, for to follow another's path is dangerous. Okay, this is an important concept being described by Sri Krishna to his warrior disciple Arjuna in this, coming toward the end of the third chapter of 18 chapters in the Bhagavad Gita. It is far better to discharge one's prescribed duties, even though faultily, than another's duties perfectly. Destruction in the course of performing one's own duty is better than engaging in another's duties, for to follow another's path is dangerous. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. One should therefore discharge his prescribed duties in full Krishna consciousness rather than those prescribed for others. Materially, prescribed duties are duties enjoined according to one's psychophysical condition under the spell of the modes of material nature. So what Prabhupada is describing here is that when first of all, the word duties, as used in this verse, means, it can mean a number of things. There are vocational duties, whatever your particular profession might be. That's one level of dharma. That's called your particular jati dharma. There's also svadharma. You may have a particular skill set. Perhaps it's not what you do for a living, but you have a particular artistic skill or practical skill of some kind or organizational skill. We were just talking, who was I talking about with you? I was talking with you about organizational skills here tonight. By the way, I want you to start, I'm sorry, I should do this, but give everyone your name, so if we're talking, they'll get to know you. No, well, we were talking earlier about organizational skills, how you're bringing them to...
I'm helping tomorrow this week in a class that she teaches at Parsons with some team building skills because some of her students are having some issues working in teams or even just organizing themselves in the first place and forming.
Well, now here's a very practical example of Tamar coming to someone whose prescribed duties, if you will, or particular skill sets may be different from her own, and saying, would you kindly come and help me with those skills here in this environment? So there's know thyself. I mean, part of the spiritual path is knowing what you're not. It's not just knowing what you are, but also what you're not. If you're not a good organizer, don't pretend. That's dangerous. That's Krishna's point. If you're not a good organizer, don't pretend to be an organizer. Here's the bottom line, okay? The bottom line of today's verse is this. It does not diminish you to bring your particular dilemma to your colleagues or your spiritual associates. It is to your credit. It not only is it okay to ask for help, it is glorious to ask for help. Why don't we always ask for help when we ought to? Peter? By the way, I just want to introduce Peter Ressler. Those of you who don't know Peter, there are some extraordinary people in this room. We don't, you know, wear labels here. You know, we're all friends. But if you kind of get to know your friends here and get together, I think you'd be quite impressed. What's one reason why we might not ask for help?
Ego.
Yeah. Meaning what? What happens?
Well, I think that we, I speak to myself, develop over time a certain perception of what is good and bad, right and wrong, respect, not lack of respect, which is based not on how I feel about myself internally, but what other people feel about me or observe on me externally.
So it might be out of embarrassment or...
Negative ego. The positive ego gets me out of bed in the morning sometimes.
Right.
All the time.
So we may feel embarrassed. By the way, is that because Captain Hook is nearby and the crocodile is coming? I'm not quite sure what that sound is. Is it the fan? What do you think? We can either live with the ticking or... It went away. Are you okay? If it gets too hot, we'll open the door. Okay, so raise your hand. You're not diminished if you're getting uncomfortable and you raise your hand and say so. Seriously. I mean, how often are you sitting, you know, uncomfortably or whatever, but you don't want to make trouble, you know? So here it's okay to make trouble. You know, whatever the thing is, just speak up. Oh, so that's the bottom line, if you will, in this verse, is you're not less because you don't know something. In fact, in the pursuit of self-awareness, the first stage, this is coming up later in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a whole long list. I'm trying to remember, is it ninth chapter? I should know these things and I don't. See, I'm admitting. There's a whole long list of the elements of enlightenment. The very, very first one on this long list of the qualities of enlightenment is humility. Humility. Humility means a willingness to admit where you are. Not posturing, you know, something greater. That's not helpful. So a willingness to say, all right, here's where I'm at. I can really use help with this. And not feeling that somehow that makes you lesser in people's eyes. If that makes you lesser in somebody's eyes, you don't really need that somebody. They haven't really understood much. So that's not where you're going to find the assistance you need anyway. I wanted to bring a practical dimension to this verse, so I've brought a little story to tell you. Is that okay? Because if we take this verse and we now transpose it into the world that we live in, and I'm getting warm now, would you mind opening the door a little bit? Thank you. If we transpose this concept into the world we live in, we find ourselves in a very tricky place. Let me give you an example. There are articles, more and more articles coming out about, I was just reading an article, for example, about should the bankers who were behind the crash in 08 not be prosecuted? There hasn't been one person prosecuted, or maybe if prosecuted, not one person convicted of any wrongdoing in this very complex arena of sales of different kinds of devices, you know, packages that led to this very painful crash. And this gets really personal. I have friends, as I guess you might, who have had to either sell their home or find some other place to be or, you know, can't find work or whatever it is. Lost their equity, you know, they have no security anymore. because of the wrongdoing of people who have never been made to pay for those transgressions. Right. Well, where do you draw the line? Right. When are we dealing with discharging one's prescribed duties, if you're a banker, say, and crossing over into some other arena? One of the reasons why, from what I'm reading, the bankers behind the crash have never been brought to justice, if you will, or prosecuted, is that the math behind these things is so complicated that it's very difficult for a court to pursue a case without incurring huge expenses, and courts have to be cautious about how they spend their budgets. Like everyone else, a court has a budget. And so there are all these other complications. Another example, if you're a soldier, let's say in the Israeli army, and you're told you must now go in and displace these settlers. Right? They're squatting. They don't have rights to this property. It's impeding the peace process. Maybe you're sympathetic with their point of view, and you're a soldier. Well, what do? Do you perform your prescribed duty, or do you say, no, that's crossing a line that I am not morally or ethically prepared to cross? Or what if you know that certain things are going on in your workplace? You and I have talked about this, Cher. You know that things are going on at work. And do you become a whistleblower and risk losing your job at a time when it's real tough to be without work? Or do you go along with it and turn a blind eye to it because you need the job? Well, that may be, in a certain sense, a transposition of this verse into real life terms. Okay? And I wanted to read you a story that, is an extreme example of this. So once more, we're going way out on a limb here. Okay. Why are we going way out on a limb? Because it has to do with a righteous Nazi. Now that may seem like a contradiction in terms, but I'm putting this out there for your consideration. And the story has to do, actually, with two people. As unpleasant as it is to contemplate in war, there is a right way and a wrong way to kill. Respect for that standard united the careers of two men who could not have been less alike in every other way. And I'm going to give you a short form, because it's a longer article, but I want to just set this up for you, and then I'd like us to talk about this. In 1942, even with shoes on, British businessman Forrest Yeo Thomas, that was his name, Yeo-Thomas, stood no more than 5'6" tall. A receding hairline, plain features, and protruding ears made him seem much older than his 32 years. He didn't mind his average appearance. The Gestapo had a hard time identifying him. Still, he did not look the part of Britain's top underground operative. Otto Skorzeny, on the other hand, was one of Europe's most recognizable celebrities. This 35-year-old daredevil stood 6'3", a dueling scar down his handsome face from ear to chin. He was Hitler's favorite commando and looked every inch the Nazi war hero. You got these two guys now? Couldn't look any more different, and yet their respective armies held them in very high esteem. From another perspective, the two men were indeed very much alike. Both were brilliant special agents endowed with sharp tactical skills and cat-like survival instincts. Each answered directly to his nation's highest authority, Yeo Thomas to Churchill, Skorzeny to Hitler. Above all, both men enjoyed, and here's the thing, both men enjoyed a reputation as gentlemen who respected the rules of war, demanded nothing of their men which they would not themselves do, and avoided causing harm whenever possible. So now I'm going to kind of abridge this longer article. They didn't know each other until later on when they met in a war crimes trial that we're going to talk about. Yeo Thomas was parachuted into France. He worked with the French underground. He was eventually captured tortured and sent to Camp Buchenwald, where eventually he was actually able to escape from Camp Buchenwald after undergoing severe trials there, and made his way back to England. He was put through horrible tortures, but survived. He went by the code name White Rabbit. That was his underground operative name. Otto Skorzeny was enlisted by Hitler to liberate Mussolini from a mountaintop prison where he was being held by Italians who were connected to the Allied forces. Skorzeny was a bit of a daredevil. He took this small glider plane, landed it on this tiny little ledge on the mountaintop with three guys, stormed this prison, walked up to the prison chief and said, "We have you surrounded. Surrender your prisoner or you will all die." The Italian guard thought about it, went into his office, came back with two glasses of champagne and said, "To the victor," and toasted him. Skorzeny took Mussolini, marched him out to the glider, brought him down the mountain, and delivered him into the hands of an ecstatic Adolf Hitler, and is credited with having been the single person most responsible for prolonging World War II, because that act rallied the Nazi forces in the early months of 1945 when everything else was lost. Skorzeny, when he learned that Hitler had killed himself and the war was over, surrendered voluntarily to the Allied forces. Nobody believed that he was who he said he was. So they said, "Well, if you want to go down the road, there's another battalion down there, you can surrender to them." They didn't believe that he was, because this man had this incredible reputation. He was known by everybody. Otto Skorzeny was like the greatest commandant that the Nazis had. Finally, when the Allied forces realized who they had in their hands, they brought him to the grounds of former concentration camp Dachau, where the Third Army had established its war crimes courts. And the prosecution against Skorzeny pivoted on this one thing, that Skorzeny had allowed his men to dress in Allied uniforms when they were doing some of their campaigns. Now that is against the conventions of land warfare. The conventions of land warfare say that you must wear a uniform that is recognizable by the enemy. You cannot disguise yourself as... These are called the rules of land war. There are ways to wage war. It has to be waged, if you will, in a clean way. And this is one of those rules that was transgressed by Skorzeny. Skorzeny's lawyer, an American colonel named Robert Durst, grilled his client for a week. Finally convinced that Skorzeny had acted honorably, Durst devised a plan for the Nazi officer's acquittal. From his reading of opinions by experts in legal theory, it seemed that international law was subject to changing usages, such as those employed by Skorzeny's commandos. If Durst could prove that Allied forces had employed similar tactics, then either the rules of war were obsolete or the Allies were equally guilty of violating international wartime regulations. Durst produced a surprise witness, the White Rabbit. He had Yo Thomas flown in from England as a witness for the defense of this top Nazi commando. On the day of Yo Thomas's testimony, Skorzeny left his prison barrack under heavy armed guard. He crossed the yard, entered the Dachau courthouse, wondering what on earth Britain's most revered undercover agent could have to say on his behalf. 200-by-100-foot courtroom, packed with press, army VIPs, residents from the Munich area, At the far end of the room, under the stars and stripes, sat an 8-man U.S. Army tribunal. Scorzini approached the dock, and what happened next took his breath away. There in the witness chair sat Yo Thomas and a dozen other American and British officers. As Scorzini approached, they rose from their seats, stood at attention, and saluted him in unison. It was a stunning gesture. I mean, I'll just read another paragraph here. One that ignored politics and press and whatever disgust it might arouse in people who knew nothing of fighting a war. They were soldiers recognizing another soldier who, like themselves, conducted his business as humanely as possible and, like them too, believed there was a right way and a wrong way to kill. Scorzini, one of the American soldiers, whispered, "Now there's a soldier." By the way, it was Yo Thomas's testimony that got Scorzini acquitted, and he was let go because the White Rabbit testified under oath that the British had done the same thing, that they'd used those same tactics of changing uniforms to fool the Nazis. So either they had to agree that this was, you know, a kangaroo court, or they had to let him go. The reason why I thought to tell you this story is not only because it's appropriate to the verse, but because yesterday I got a phone call. Hello, is this Professor Green? Yeah. Well, how do you do, Professor Green? You don't know me. My name is Richard, and I'm a teacher here in North Carolina. I'm a retired Army colonel. And I just wanted you to know that I read your article there about Otto Scorzini. And I thought I could talk to you about it. Well, what can I do for you? Well, sure. Ever since I was a little boy, I always wanted to be a soldier. My daddy was a soldier, and his daddy before him was a soldier. I wanted to be a soldier. And so I've been in three services. I've been in the Air Force, the Marines, and the Army. My dream all my life when I was a boy was to see battle. And when I learned about Otto Scorzini and the way he had conducted himself in war, my dream became someday that I would have liked to have been in battle and met him. That's my great dream. I would have loved to have done that. So I just wanted to thank you for your article and tell you that I've taken out my life savings and I have purchased Otto Scorzini's archives. And I now have in my possession Otto Scorzini's private photographic diary of his whole life history and his letters to the American friends that he made when he was there in the court in Dachau. And if that can be of any use for some purpose, I hope you will let me know. Well, I certainly will. Thank you very much. Out of nowhere, I get this phone call. So, it may be the single most controversial area of historic discussion in this multifaceted universe called the Holocaust, is the humanizing of the enemy. Very, very difficult thing. Not an easy thing to talk about. And yet it is at the core of the yogic way of life, isn't it? Right? To exercise compassion. Right? To see that this man, according to this verse in the Bhagavad Gita, was performing his prescribed duties to the best of his ability. Now we may no doubt differ with his politics, and question why he would support such a heinous regime. But we're not soldiers, and we don't quite know what it's like to be under those conditions and to recognize another soldier doing his prescribed duty to the best of his ability.
Able to, or being willing not to judge someone unless you can stand in their shoes.
Ah, yes, yeah. Yeah, familiar with that Native American saying, don't judge another until you've walked a mile in his moccasins? People say, until you've walked in his shoes. Well, that's because we wear shoes and we think everyone wears shoes. Yeah. It's a very, very difficult thing to do, especially when you're dealing with extreme crime. I mean, can you forgive someone who has killed perhaps even your family members? It's asking a lot. So that may be an extreme case, but I'm curious to know what your thoughts are here. I mean, what are we made of? You know, at what point do we perhaps find our limits? Does our sense of compassion have a limit? Perhaps should it have a limit? How do you strike a balance between compassion and due process of law? You can't have a civilization without law. And if you have law, then you're going to have standards of behavior, and if those standards are transgressed, there's going to be punishment. In some cases, severe punishment. Okay, let's talk about it. And this is practical. This is practical stuff here, and that's what we're here for. I want to get into the nitty-gritty of what the Bhagavad Gita means. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. Are you familiar with Viktor? Tell me your name.
Sharon.
Sharon is referencing Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Are you familiar with this book? If you're not, you should. It's a very little book, and I would recommend that you get it and that you read it. It won't take you long, but it is a book that has had a very profound impact on a lot of people. It has its problems, as all books do. One of the problems is that Viktor Frankl's sense of our ability to survive even under extreme conditions. That's an interesting idea. Speaking of extreme conditions. Is to find some meaning to hold on to. And he talked about having been in a concentration camp, and those who survived from his perception were those who had something that they were able to continue to meditate on, whether it's a book they had been writing before they were sent to the camps, or family members who may still be alive. There are some drawbacks to that. It's a somewhat privileged perspective. What if you weren't writing a novel or don't have family? But nonetheless, and he also wasn't in a concentration camp for very long, about 2 weeks. So he was basing his book on limited experience. Nonetheless, it's had a very profound effect. So your question is this exercise like Viktor Frankl's book? Good, thank you. Other associations or issues? Yes. Introduce yourself.
I'm Sandy. My question is prescribed by whom?
Ah, very good. Did you all pick up on that?
No.
Who gets to decide what is a prescribed duty? Excellent. Gold star. How do you determine appropriate behavior? And when that appropriate behavior is being transgressed. If we learn anything from war, it's don't lose. Because history is written by the victors. One army's hero is another army's war criminal.
Don't we get our prescribed behavior from our teachers?
Okay. Well, now we're getting into the tools of analysis, if you will, of spiritual life. Once again, the bottom line from our gathering today, from me reading this verse, is you are not diminished It does not count against you somehow. If you are confronted with a dilemma and you're not sure what your prescribed duty is, and you bring it to your spiritual colleagues, you bring it here. That's one of the benefits of what we do here every week. It kind of surprises me, actually, that there isn't more of that kind of interaction. Let me encourage you to do so. Every one of us here is confronting some kind of a dilemma. What's life without a dilemma? And you know what they say? When you're handed a dilemma, make dilemonade. So bring it. Bring it. Let's talk about it. Anybody got a dilemma? Tamar?
I don't have a dilemma quite yet, but I wanted to mention something in the sidebar that perhaps not everybody knows, that the class is being recorded for an audio podcast. And so when there's participation from the audience, it's great when people could speak up.
Yeah.
It's helpful. And if you don't want what you're saying recorded, you can also say that and Michael will turn it off. So I just wanted people to know that.
Right. Yes, we're being heard on.
Yeah,
and I can, if we don't have a microphone to pass around, maybe I can repeat the question.
Yeah.
Yeah. The downside here is that those jokes cannot now be retracted. Right. Okay. I have to look out for that. Other thoughts, reflections on this verse? You know, there's something that Prabhupada says. Let me read this to you. In the purport on page 172, for a Kshatriya or a warrior, it is better to be vanquished following the rules of violence than to imitate a Brahmin who follows the principles of nonviolence. Everyone has to cleanse his heart by a gradual process, not abruptly. Take your time. I think part of what's being said in this verse is don't become too impatient if there's some delay in the attainment of your yoga life. It's going to take time. We've been here a long, long, long time. The conditioning runs very deep. The notion of prescribed duties, if you will, for us yogis would be watch your diet. Watch your diet. You are what you eat. Could not apply any more critically than to those who are on a yoga path. Look out for anything that alters perceptions, even coffee and tea. You know, anything that stimulates the system unnecessarily, that pollutes the system, is a distraction. Right? Stay clean. Cleanliness is next to godliness. I mean, there are some basic things. And follow your practice every day. Whatever you can do, do it regularly. It doesn't have to be a big deal. You know, do something little but regularly every day. That's much more effective than going way up, you know, doing 5 hours of yoga today and then nothing tomorrow. Keep a regulated diet for yourself. Right. Now listen to this. However, when one transcends the modes of material nature and is fully situated in Krishna consciousness, he can perform anything and everything under the direction of a bona fide spiritual master. In that complete stage of Krishna consciousness, the Kshatriya may act as a Brahmin, or the Brahmin may act as a Kshatriya. In the transcendental stage, the distinctions of the material world do not apply. That's stunning. That is stunning. And that is, if you will, setting the bar. It's where we would like to get to. There is a place in the cultivation of your awareness of yourself as a spiritual being, where you can do anything. You can go into any circumstance and you will know what to do, and you can be a contribution there. But don't do that if you're not ready for it. Don't pretend to be more spiritually advanced than you are. Same lesson. You are not diminished by honestly saying, I can only go this far right now. To do more than that would be dangerous for me. Yeah.
Going back to when Merle was here talking about leadership and the idea of, you know, sometimes you got to fake it till you make it. But then, I don't know, when we talk about admitting that you need help, so that seems a little like oil and water to me.
Anyone else have a take on that? How many of you were here when Mel Toomey was our guest speaker? Okay, good, good. I'm glad so many of you had the opportunity to hear him talk about the difference between management skills and leadership skills. Really fine presentation. So the question, I'm sorry,
Nick,
the question that Nick's raising is, isn't there a contradiction here? Because Mel was talking about, how would you describe it?
A lot of it was keeping your followers inspired and mm-hmm. motivated.
Right, even if you have to, even you don't always know where you're going, and so even if you have to kind of like fake it going out there, how does that jive with this idea of not overstepping or transgressing your actual abilities? Anyone have a response to that? You always have good answers. Tamar?
Trusting your intuition.
Mm-hmm. Trusting intuitions. So there doesn't, that's not necessarily a contradiction then, is that your point? Trusting intuitions is not necessarily a contradiction in remaining within your appropriate sphere of activity. In fact, I think what Mel was saying was, whatever you're doing, be a leader by being willing to ask the questions that maybe someone with a little bit more ego might not be prepared to ask. I don't know. What do you think? That doesn't diminish you in whatever your role is. I think his point was it enhances it. So I think there's a symmetry here. Yes, saw a hand. Yeah.
Well, I think also that if it's like your prescribed duty to be a leader, then you should be moving in that direction. But if you're faking it because you want to be a leader but don't really have the abilities to do so, that's, mm-hmm. I think, the difference. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going around.
I think that's what the difference is in this, but also it's not necessarily. Like if you are that leader and you're taking it to be a leader, that's what you're supposed to be doing, you mm-hmm. have that intuition of, this is really going to work, but people need to kind of follow you until I get to that point.
This is coming up in the 12th or 16th chapter. So in about 2014, we'll be talking about this, where Krishna describes the Paramatma feature, how he personally dwells. He's the indwelling guide in the heart, what Tamar was describing as intuition. Sometimes we talk about our best intuitions or that voice of wisdom within us. The Gita gives that personality. The Gita gives that inner voice a form, a shape, a name, and calls it Paramatma. Paramatma, the higher soul within ourselves. That's there if we allow it to come through. As Peter was saying, sometimes the ego gets in the way. We don't listen to that. We're listening to something else. But I think that is kind of where we're going in this discussion of how to both be faithful to your prescribed duties and also stretch that boundary. Right? Any other thoughts?
Mm-hmm. I would like to share a quote that came up across my desk today. Mm-hmm. It's by Emerson. To be yourself in a world that is constantly trying to make you something else is the greatest accomplishment.
To be yourself in a world that is constantly
trying to make you something else.
To make you something else is the greatest accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a very similar verse by the poet E.E. Cummings. As a matter of fact, Michael, if you remind me, I'd like to send you that E.E. Cummings verse and we'll make that one of our handouts. The verse goes like this: to be yourself in a world that is doing its best day and night to make you everybody else is to fight the hardest battle any human being can fight and never stop fighting. Isn't that amazing? What's the glitch here? The glitch is... Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Are we drawing any distinction between our spiritual duty? So as you described, you know, right diet, keep yourself clean, and another one that... Oh, and daily practice. And the rest of our lives? Or is it all somehow...
Good question. Any thoughts? I should repeat the question, right? Should I do that? Are we talking about spiritual duties as kind of on their own? And our material lives, are they separate realms or are they somehow one and the same? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Peter. Sure. I'm going to give you back that question. I mean, you must have some intuition of your own.
Because you're very clearly saying, you know, this is our, these are our duties. But in the story that you read, where did those duties come from? I mean, were those spiritual duties because they came from their bosses in a professional context?
Okay, I see. I think I'm understanding your question. Yeah, it's become a bit of a cliche that everything is spiritual, you know, if you just see it that way. I don't think so. There are material duties and there are spiritual duties. You can bring a deeper mindset to what you do. It would be a tough argument that conducting yourself as a soldier is de facto part of your spiritual practice. For some, it may be possible for a rare few, not for most people. It's like saying, it's like sex, you know, saying sex is spiritual. Well, maybe for a rare few who are on such a very advanced level that you can understand how that fits through the lens of our spiritual journey. It's not for everyone. You can't just jump up to that. So I would have to say for myself, I mean, I would give that a qualified yes, that it's possible, but it's not easily attained. It's not easily achieved. I think that's what Prabhupada means here. When one transcends the modes of material nature and is fully situated in Krishna consciousness, he can perform anything. And even then, Prabhupada qualifies it by saying, under the direction of a bona fide spiritual master. So even there, when you want to perform your material duty as part of your sadhana, you want to integrate something into your spiritual practice that may not be directly chanting, meditating, practicing yoga, there's a right way and a wrong way to do that. And that's where the teachers and the teachings and the sangha come in. We have to be careful about inventing spiritual practices or arbitrarily investing a spiritual dimension into what we do. It's not that simple. Talk it through, people. Bring it here. And I'll do that with you. I will tell you straight up, if there's something that I haven't understood yet, I would welcome your input. I would really welcome it. I'll do that. I'll go first. I don't care. What the heck? I'm teaching 27 freshmen 3 days a week out at Hofstra University, and I really question whether I should continue teaching. I really question it. It's like breaking stones. I'm trying, you know, you're trying to get through to these precious young lives, and what do I blame it on? The Bush administration, the economy, the water? I don't know what to blame it on.
How do you know you're
Oh, thank you. That's where you see? That's very helpful. Did you get that? Did you all hear that? How do I know I'm not getting through? You're right, I'm judging this materially. I'm looking at it and saying, I don't think I'm getting through. Maybe I am, and 10 years from now, someone's going to come knocking on my door and say, hey, remember me? I don't know. It's good. Thank you, Peter. Very good. April.
Over, if I may, I'm going to give a little short story that's...
Sure. Pass this back, because I want everyone to hear this, whatever the story is.
Over the summer, I was teaching yoga to some teenagers who were stuck with me for the summer because they didn't feel like going to gym the first time around. So they were stuck in summer school gym, and I was teaching them yoga every day. At the same time, I was participating in a no-impact week that Tamar was leading, and the kids every day they thought I was crazy. I was riding my bike to work every day. I was eating different foods. I wasn't making trash. I was, like, doing all these things, and they thought I was insane. But every single day when I came in, they asked me what I was doing that day and what my challenge was. And even though they were kind of making fun of it in a way, they came on their own, would ask me questions about it. And it was good enough for me that they were even thinking about it. Even though, and these kids came from a world that was very different from ours. They're all low income. They all basically, essentially live in a garbage dump for real, like in the South Bronx or in Washington Heights, where there is an actual garbage dump in the South Bronx. And although part of me was like, well, I'm not getting, like, I told them I had made some trash, and they were like, well, why don't you just throw it out the window? And the response really bothered me, but then the day after, they would continuously ask me questions about what I was doing, and it was kind of enough that they were thinking about it for me, even though I knew in that moment I wasn't making this huge change. But, you know, so with your students, you know, a year, 10 years, whatever, they may say, oh, Professor Green was talking about this, and it made me think about it a little bit. They may not necessarily, especially if they're 18, be really receptive to it right now, but they may at some point.
Okay. So don't give up.
Yeah, I don't think you should. Okay. But it also depends on what it is that you feel like you're not getting through.
Yeah.
Or what are you getting at?
Well, part of it has to do with the requirements that are set by the university and by the Board of Regents, which requires you to do blah, 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 and it takes away from the actual teaching. We in the academy call it administrivia. And it's really a pain in the neck, you know, where, you know, you're spending more time on useless stuff than on teaching, and you want to get into it. So that's part of it. And, you know, so I kind of throw my hands up sometimes and lament the state of education. But I thank you, April and Peter, for your wise words. All right, I'll keep going for a while. Anyone else? It's free. Just yeah, Karen.
I had one of my clients at the salon I work at in New Jersey. She's going to a freshman year of college, some university in Rhode Island, and all the freshmen are required of us to read No Impact Man. She just has to read this stupid book. And I'm like, what is it? And she's like, No Impact Man. At first I go, oh, you have to come to Jivamukti. And then I'm talking to her mother about No Impact Man. But I thought that was pretty cool. The university, that's what they're requiring all the freshmen to read coming in.
Not bad.
And I was like, sure. Yeah, and I guess he's going there to speak and stuff, too.
Yeah, there's some hope, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, good. Yeah. Say your name.
Casey. I have a friend who's Buddhist, and then that philosophy which teach about this sort of you find everything within yourself, and you don't really need any sort of guide, a book or anything like that to follow. But I find that impractical. I mean, I'm an imperfect individual. If I knew everything, I would be enlightened automatically. So I definitely need a teacher to show me how to do certain things. So, with that being said, how do I find what my prescribed duty in life materially. I know what it is spiritually. It's to go back to the spiritual world. But materially, how do I find that? Do I find that within? Do I see the guru? How, on a material level, am I finding what my prescribed duty is supposed to be?
Wonderful question. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you. Prayer is very helpful. Prayer is probably the greatest resource I've ever known. You have to ask. The question will come. The answer will come if the question is asked. So ask the question, first of all, which is what prayer is. It's asking for some intervention. The other we've been discussing is you've got friends right here. You got a group right here that loves you and is prepared to help any way they can. Am I right?
Yeah.
You know, that's, I think, why we come together. You know, so it's okay to do this. It's okay to come here and do something other than just listening to Yogeshwara yak for an hour and a half. As a matter of fact, that's a good idea. Let me make a suggestion here. It's 9:18. Why don't we stop and you guys talk for a while, you know? Go over to somebody you don't know and just talk for a while. You know?
Why don't we do that for 5 minutes? Can we do that? Go for somebody you don't know.